Susie Banyan decided to perfect her ballet studies in the most famous school of dance in Europe. She chose the celebrated Academy of Fribourg. One day at 9 in the morning, she left Kennedy Airport, New York, and arrived in Germany at 10:40 p.m. local time.
Yes, I'm Susie Banyan.
Welcome to our academy.
You're pretty. Very pretty indeed. Something terrible, truly horrible has happened. One of our students, Pat Hinkle, who was expelled just yesterday for improper conduct, was murdered last night by some madman.
Enough! You know what happened? The most disgusting dog has bitten Albert!
Who's there? Who's there?
Pat got murdered by a madman, and now Daniel is killed by his dog.
Yeah, maybe there's a hex on the place.
Looking for Sam, she'll disappear.
But that's impossible. I just asked her for last night.
She left this morning, as a matter of fact.
She had discovered that the Tam Academy was founded by a witch. Among the initiated, she went by the name the Black Queen.
Why do you have all this interest in the occult?
Because some friends spoke to me about witches.
I'm convinced that the current spread of belief in magic and the occult is part of mental illness. Bad luck isn't brought by broken mirrors, but by broken minds.
We must get rid of that bitch of an American girl. Vanish, she must vanish. Make her disappear.
Go away, Dick. Go now! I've been expecting you. You wanted to kill me. You wanted to kill me. What are you going to do now? Hell is behind that door.
Suspiria by Dario Argento is one of the greatest cinematic experiences of my life. It is a film that you don't intellectually necessarily need to comprehend as you're watching it, but you're going to feel and be hit by the movie on a physical, artistic level, like nothing I've ever experienced in a horror film, that's for sure. At its simplest form, it's about a young American dancer who goes to Germany, to the Black Hills, Black Hills of Germany, into a dance conservatory where she slowly unfolds a coven of witches and the dark arts that have been preying on kind of the power of younger women. You know, the plot of that film is about as paper thin as you can get with horror cinema. It's much more in line with a fairy tale. You'd tell almost like a children's Grimm fairy tale, but it sucks you in an aesthetics way where film, basically the style of the film becomes the substance itself. And it really has to be seen to be believed.
Hello, and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jason Jenkins. Call me Jinx. And that was Elric Kane talking about Dario Argento's 1977 masterpiece, Suspiria. Mr. Kane was a host of horror talk show, Inside Horror, and currently co-hosts both the Blumhouse podcast, Shockwaves, as well as the new Pure Cinema podcast. Both are essential listening, so make certain to check out each if you haven't already. And before we begin, a bit of warning. The only thing more terrifying than the last 12 minutes of this podcast will be the first 92. Mr. Kane, thanks so much for being on the show.
Let's hope we can live up to that.
Okay, so I should probably say, I don't know that that's how long this episode is going to run, but, you know, I thought it was a good way to open. So,
all right. Yeah, no, we could spend a lot longer on the aesthetics. If we limit it to plot, then I think we've already covered the plot. It's pretty thin, but, you know, in a way that... I think the thing in cinema is you can't have it all. You really can't. You can't. And I remember reading an essay about film by French director Robert Bresson, and he would always talk about you can't be all ear and all eye at the same time. It's a relay race between your senses. So if you've covered what needed to be expressed visually with the eye, then you can have less going on with the sense of the ear. And then in some parts, you want, the ear is the more dominant mode, and then you kind of pass the baton, and that's the way to construct a movie. You know, I feel like too often in Hollywood, especially if you look at, say, a superhero type of movie, or even a lot of horror films, where the scare will be bombastic and something frightening jumping out at you at the same time, and then it's ultimately kind of hollow. In Suspiria, there's this, you know, just incredible dance between the two, and at times they are both going full force at you, but you're always being guided by your visual audio senses. You're not being guided just by plot, and I think that's because the choice has been made that I can't also fit in an Akiva Goldsman script for you to follow that much character and plot as well as move you through the aesthetics. And that was clearly, you know, his choice to make an expressionistic movie, but in color.
So do you think there's a chance that you could actually, well, before I ask this question, I'm sorry, we usually start out by asking, you know, given the option of choosing any horror movie to chat about, why is it that you went specifically with Suspiria instead of any number of other horror films?
You mean instead of Possession?
Instead of Possession, yes.
Well, it's hard to know. You know, I listen to your show, so I will sometimes hear why people have chosen a film which I enjoy. I think that is a neat part of the show. You know, the film I've talked about the most the last few years to people is Possession, but what they don't realize is not necessarily my favorite movie of all time. It's that it's the one that had no, you know, there's no spotlight being on Shine. That when I saw that film and really started kind of telling people, that was well before there was a touring print and rediscovery and a new Blu-ray. So that was a movie that needed champions, and so it's still, you know, one of my favorite movies in my, you know, top few. But in terms of if asked about a horror film, there's a couple films, The Shining, which is, you know, pretty straightforward, The Beyond, which I believe maybe somebody had already done, I can't remember, or if there's a reason why I didn't choose that, and then Suspiria. Those are the kind of movies that, you know, just they, I never really stopped thinking about them, and I know why it is. It's because all these films have in common is they can't be pinned down. You can't just write your dissemination about what it's about because, well, you can, but it's not going to be the final word on that movie. It's going to be your interpretation of that movie. These films are all laid out for you to interpret how you want, and what you bring to the movie is equal to what the movie's giving you. Unlike, you know, the majority of movies that are basically, to me, a closed book. They're this is how you're going to interpret it. This is how you're going to feel. And that's that. But all of those movies feel different, and which means they kind of change with you. I always find every few years, if I re-see one of them, I'll find something new or something different that I'm responding to. And even the perspective of which characters you relate to change. So Suspiria is one that I think in terms of cinema as art and horror film, you know, as art, it's unparalleled. When in terms of horror films, it's the most beautiful, special, aesthetic horror film ever made. I don't think there's even competition in my mind. But I'd also put it in, say, the top 10 of all cinema aesthetically for like what it was trying to do with a movie and successfully doing.
Now, can I ask, you know, talking about the movie and, you know, the fact that it is, you know, very stylish and very moody, and it does trade an atmosphere quite a bit, perhaps more so than plot. Do you think the movie would be as successful as it is if you did, or if Argento had attempted to impose any sort of more complex plot or even a theme or, you know, any sort of obvious subtext into the film rather than what the movie has right now? Or do you think it needed to be sort of this? I mean, it's kind of a living nightmare at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think, sure, to subtext possibly, and there probably is subtext going on of all sorts, you know, again, that would you would bring to it yourself, and maybe there's a lot of artistic references to different artists and different movements, so there's a lot in this movie. Like, I can see a lot of influences of where it's coming from. Not all of them will necessarily be right, but I can see a lot of them. I don't think it would be as successful if he had a lot and more of a, you know, more of a conventional story, because I think it's definitely in the top two or three of being the closest I think anyone's been able to capture a nightmare on a screen. That feeling of, you know, what people always throw around the term for Lynch, especially, you know, dream logic. But I don't think it's just dream logic. I think it's I do think it's fairy tale logic. And I think it's a very purposeful play on his part to make this more like a child's fairy tale, which are super dark. You know, people, I don't mean like a kid's thing, you know, an American kid's thing. I mean like Germanic fairy tales and the Grimm brothers are these just incredibly dark stories, but their logic, the logic of this movie seems to play to that more than it does a traditional movie logic, and the way characters react to things I think definitely fits in more in line with that. So I think it's very purposeful on that front. So I definitely don't think the film could be bettered. Like, for instance, they're remaking the movie, of course, right now. And the director they've chosen, I butcher his name, but his first name's Luca. his name is Luca. He lives on the second floor. He's an incredible visualist as well, and made a film called I Am Love. And it could be great, but it's not going to be this film, and I'm not at all threatened that some new Suspiria is going to replace the old Suspiria, because it's not. It doesn't matter if they take the story to adapt. Hey, more power to them. You know, you're making a film about a girl at a dance academy with witches, you know. enjoy that. Enjoy that deep premise. It's these experiments that they were doing with film, because this isn't one of many that Dario had done at this point. This is the first film that he had taken these bold visual steps into. You know, his previous films were relatively straight giallo films, you know, with certainly a little bit of flair of color, but not real, nothing compared to making a film built out of the emotions being different colors and expression. His other films, as beautiful as they are, like Bird with Crystal Plumage, I think is a great, his first feature is just a gorgeous looking film, but it's just, you know, because it's shot well, it's not experimental in any way. They're all grounded very much in realism. So this was, you know, a really bold move coming up to whatever it was, his fifth or so movie with Suspiria. So I definitely don't think it can be improved, and I think it is, you know, I think it's exactly what it needed to be.
Absolutely. And it is, you know, if I'm being honest, you know, story usually sort of trumps not everything else, but, you know, when it comes to the types of films that I like, you know, I do lean towards story driven films. And in Suspiria's case, you know, there is very little plot to be found, you know, at least early on. You know, the film seems to be sort of a series of beautifully made set pieces linked together, you know, by the lead and the location, but it really works, you know, under Argento's, you know, direction, you know. And I'm sort of more than willing to go for the ride when it comes to Suspiria, because it's so very well made, and because it feels like, you know, you're sort of traipsing around a nightmare, you know, the images and the music and that sort of nightmarish quality that sort of envelops you as you're viewing it. And, you know, what is it about this movie specifically, do you think, other than just, you know, the craft with which it was made, that makes it work so very well without having a plot to be leaned on, as it were?
Well, I think it's, again, I think it's funny. It's all those things you said are why it works. It works because it doesn't have a plot to lean on. It works because it's using the style. It's pushing the style to become the substance of the film. The style is the story of the film. It took bold risks that might not have worked. So the bold stylistic choices it makes could just fall flat. And I've seen a lot of stylish movies which have been shot with lots of filters and you know, gels, and that do nothing for me. It feels contrived. But that's not the case. I'm sure for some people it's the case of Suspiria. But for the majority of people who love this film, something has hit, I would say, in the same place where Lynch has always been successful, which is the unconscious. I think this is a film made that while we're watching it, we're probably processing it a lot more unconsciously than we are consciously, because our conscious mind would be much more interested in plot development and twists and, oh, I wonder if this is going to happen next. That I think that's what Hollywood is operating on most of the time with a screenplay. And I think this film's not doing that. It's very simple for us to follow, but it means we're taking in all these things like, oh, what does this green mean? What is this blue doing? Oh my God, what is this pulsating soundtrack mean? Does it mean something's about to happen, or does it, like, it's outside of our ability to understand movies, because you hadn't seen a movie like that before. I mean, like, let's take it back to the first time I saw this movie. I didn't fully get it, and a friend of mine, first year of college, had it on VHS, the same friend who showed me Blue Velvet the first time, which I also didn't get on first viewing. And both are now, you know, top five movies for me. That very first viewing is takes you to such a place that if you haven't seen a lot of films by that kind of a filmmaker yet, when you see it, you have nothing to compare it to. It's like walking a high wire without a net. It's like could just completely fail. And I definitely had a kind of a slightly negative reaction to the story. Like I know that there was something great going on in this, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And it wasn't until the next time I saw it that I was like, oh, wow, that's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And Blue Velvet had a very similar effect. So I think that's what it is. It's a process of understanding something that you can't put into words, but you still are projecting into and you're still feeling it. I think just saying it's a film you can feel but not necessarily understand is a great way to think about it. I think that was from one of these little books that they're one company's releasing, where they're like looking at individual films like that and The Descent and other ones. And you know, there's some interesting quotes in there that kind of made me think, oh yeah, that might be as simple as that.
I got you. Now, can I ask, you mentioned, you know, having watched Suspiria for the first time, was Suspiria your first experience with Argento?
Yes, and so that's part of it. So and Blue Velvet, I think, was my first. Lynch, with Lynch, I had seen Twin Peaks. So there was a bed of, you know, being able to go weird, but not as dark necessarily as Blue Velvet. There's, you know, sexually very dark. So with Argento, and I only mention them because they're right next to each other when I saw them, these two films. So no, Suspiria is the first thing. And I'd say, look, I was a big, you know, anyone who listens to Shockwaves who's listening is, or Killer POV knows, you know, I've been a big horror fan as a kid, watched everything, but kind of in my 20s, didn't watch as much, went more towards art house films because I kind of, maybe what was happening at that time in horror didn't really grab me as much as the stuff that I grew up on. And so I kind of maybe thought I had outgrown it, and it really wasn't outgrowing it. It was just rediscovering the stuff that turns you on. And when I saw things like House of the Devil and Descent, I was right back in and have been ever since. And I think with Suspiria, I just, you know, it was like, it was nothing like other, I hadn't seen much Italian horror either. I might have seen Zombie. But even Fulci doesn't even really prepare you for Argento, especially this film. You know, probably the only director who maybe could have prepared me from the Italian cinema a little bit would have been Mario Bava. The visual beauty, for sure. Like I was just talking on the last Shockwaves about Drop of Water, the segment from the anthology Black Sabbath. And I think I can see the influence of that in a huge way on Argento Suspiria. You can see the hand of that master on a lighting experimental side, expressionistic side, totally influencing Dario, but not on a danger side. There's nothing particularly dangerous about Mario Bava's work. This film is just so, I mean, the opening of this movie is so good. I think basically the opening of 20 minutes of this movie is up there as like top one or two things I've seen in horror cinema, up there with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, the sequence with the dinner table and the way she's feeling up till she jumps out the window. Like those sequences of a movie that are so unrelenting, you can't even really take a breath because you don't know what the fuck's happening. You know, you mentally, you're like, I did find a great quote where Argento said, you know, I wanted to make something at the start that with such intent, the intensity of the level of how horror films tend to end. So as the audience would think, where the hell can this go? Because it's so intense. I mean, and it's very clever because what it does is it doesn't do it to the protagonist. It introduces the protagonist and she takes us to the school, and then she witnesses this other girl doing something. And then we follow this other girl. So, and then the other girl comes to, you know, one of the most horrific endings imaginable. And because it just pulled kind of almost like a psycho opening, but without being, you know, literal or scream, it's a great way to catch you off guard because you're like, oh, if that's a possibility, then something bad's going to happen to the rest of you. You know, like it's really one of the great openings of any film. Like I said, it's dangerous. It's the way it uses the color and light from the get-go. I mean, she gets off, Susie Banyan arrives at an airport. And I think it's really interesting from if you watch the opening scene, there's a narrating voice that's going to tell you the story like a fairy tale. It's going to say, Susie Banyan, you know, arrived at the airport, and the voice starts trailing off into silence as this prog rock metal takes it. It almost says like, hey, those old rules are over. Like, you're not going to have the safety of a narrator's voice for this movie. Then this crazy like metal and like whispering of witch spirit, you know, goblin, this incredible prog rock band Goblin starts kicking in, and there's already weird green flashes of light on the background of what should be a normal Munich or German airport. So I feel like it's kind of saying, as soon as she walks through the door, oh, things are different now. You're in a different world. This is very much, I know for sure Wizard of Oz is an influence on this. You know, she's definitely Dorothy coming from her innocent Kansas into what's going to be like a Technicolor nightmare of some kind. And they're warning her from the get-go that the doors of the airport open, and the wind literally pushes her almost back through the doors to say, no, don't come, you know? And then the taxi driver drives right by her, says, I'm not picking you up, don't come. So it's like, it's classic warnings, you know, telling her to turn back, but she pursues, you know, and continues into her adventure that she has to go through like a fairy tale. But it's pretty, I mean, it's pretty radical.
That opening is amazing. I hadn't revisited the movie in some time, and rewatching it again recently for this chat, like I was really struck by how unusual, you know, that opening is. I mean, that narration coming at the midpoint of the opening credits, I think it's on, is it, I think like the director of photography's credit, maybe, you know, when Argento's mm-hmm. voice comes up, and that blew me away too, the fact that it was, you know, the narrator is Argento himself. But you know, that's such a strange way to start off. You know, no text, just narration, and the function that it serves, you're right, is, you know, it's not based on a true story so much as, you know, once upon a time. And
yeah,
God, I there's so much, it should almost be comic in a way when, you know, Jessica Harper's Susie is strolling through the airport and, you know, that amazing goblin theme starts up, and we realize that it's only playing when the automatic doors of the airport open up and reveal the thunderstorm, you know, outside, you know, and they shut.
It was a dark and stormy night.
Yeah.
Is what it's basically saying, right?
Yeah. And even, you know, there is that look on her face as she's approaching the doors. And, you know, I mean, logically, she is concerned about the storm that's raging outside, but it almost plays as a reaction to this music that's only playing, you know, when the doors are opening and shutting, you know, and
it could be like she's almost sensing that music. She's sensing that presence because the score is definitely feels like a haunted presence. It doesn't just feel like an isolated musical track. Sometimes in some of the parts, it feels like the attack itself is the music, and that these are like demons, you know, floating above you, and which is like, you know, coming, diving at you, and you know, coming at you the way the intensity changes. So it's almost like she's hearing these voices, even though we know it's probably not possible.
And we are, what, 1 minute in at this point? And already we are unsettled. You know, we're, you know, we have that. We have her strolling through the airport. We have that amazing music. We have the storm raging outside and she's approaching it. You know, we have those, you know, attempts at communicating with her cab driver. You know, it's all unsettling, but at the same time, it all looks so beautiful. And it feels like within, you know, the space of a minute or two that we've been sort of, you know, dumped right into the middle of, you know, a fairy tale or a nightmare. And then absolutely a nightmare, you know, as, you know, Susie sort of glimpses the young woman as a Pat, I think, stumbling through the forest, you know, as the music sort of goes into this terrifying drum beat. But, you know, the fact that we go from something that's so, you know, sort of super atmospheric and kind of, you know, very classy in its own way, you know, with that music and those images, and, you know, within the space of 10 minutes, we are assaulted with one of the goriest deaths any slasher movie has ever seen, you know, and yet Argento makes it feel all of one piece, you know, and I think he does that better than most filmmakers that I can think of anyway, you know, most horror filmmakers, you know, shooting these really heinous and violent acts, but in such a gorgeous way, you know, and all while keeping that sort of, you know, masterful control of tone. And I can, you know, one can only imagine what audiences must have made of that movie in 1977.
Yeah, well, one other director springs to mind that obviously influenced him that we talked a lot about this last week in my life, but is that one of the quotes about Hitchcock was that he filmed his murder scenes like love scenes and his love scenes like murder scenes. And I think that's like perfect analogy for Hitchcock. But I think that also bleeds into what Argento's taking. You know, he's obviously a big influence on Argento's work, more clearly his earlier films, the giallo. But then in this, it's I think that maybe slightly the other influence of opera. I mean, we can't downplay, and I can't really ever fully understand not being Italian, the role that opera and the aesthetics of opera must play in how they watch movies and the kind of movies they can make, because they're just bigger in every way. The emotion's bigger, the music's bigger, the, you know, the costumes are big, everything just has this kind of opulent sense. So I think what sets Dario apart, and the reason why we are still talking about this movie, it's literally 40 years now. It's 40 years since this movie. The movie's older than I am, just, you know, is because that he found a way to merge these two things that might not work. Because I do think Mario Bava was already doing some of the, you know, visual experimental stuff that's happening in this movie already existed to extent, but not the gory, not mixing this with just these absolutely brutal and stylized and also unsettlingly weird. These are the parts where that first murder is the part where it really becomes like a nightmare, because it's one thing we've seen a giallo or a slasher movie where some human is stalking you and kills you. But, you know, she goes to this darkened window of her friend's apartment, and these eyeballs glow in the dark suddenly, which I remember just being terrified when I first saw that. And then she looks again closer, and this arm that looks like it's from Fluffy from the Creep Show, the crate, this giant, long, weird, hairy arm that I think was probably Argento, it's always his hands, grabs her and smashes her face, and she's pushed like her nose right up against the glass, and it's one of the, until it breaks the glass, and it's one of those. Absolutely, it's, you know, definitely up there as one of my favorite, you know, murder sequences in a film, because it's just, that is literally, if you had interviewed her the second before it happened, that is the worst case scenario. You know, if you said what is the worst way to die, she'd probably go, you know what, it probably is looking out this window and an actual creature being there with a hairy arm pulling my face. I mean, I can't think of a worse thing to happen to you in that moment, and it all happens. And then, you know, then she you know, gets hung and her heart's being stabbed in this crazy close-up. That those are the moments that are, this is what I mean by like, and saying that to keep me interested in horror as a genre that I need from filmmakers. And luckily, I feel like I'm getting a lot more than I ever would have expected in the last few years, which is people taking big chances and risks to achieve a vision. This year, you'll see a movie called Raw that just, like, you know, does some things where you're like, oh, shit, I wouldn't do that in a movie if I was you. And then they do it and you're like, wow, you know, and I think that's what's happening. It's like, it's very easy to show a woman stabbed in the heart in the scene, and you could show it photorealistically, no problem. He has the heart not even in the human when he shows it, more or less. It's this totally artificial, like, weird close-up of this beating thing, and then a knife going into it, and it's there to make you feel something other than real life. It's meant to feel like a weird impression or nightmarish, you know, idea of being stabbed in the heart. So those are the kind of things that could just totally fail. And that's why when it doesn't fail and these things come together, you can't logically put it together and tell somebody why this movie works. It's one of the few films where I'd be like, hey, you just have to see it. You know, there's nothing I can do to tell you how Suspiria works. You know, I'm hoping people listening have watched it first. But if they haven't, you know, hopefully they'll run out and do it in the middle. But I think that's a big part of it. This opening sequence and the way it ends with the shards of glass. And the when she's being hung, the shards of glass look like a kaleidoscope, almost like a church's, you know, window, stained windows. And that's another way to view the movie, is imagine you're watching on a traditional horror film, but you were watching it from inside, say, a chapel, and you're outside looking through the colored, you know, stained glass windows. I would say that's another way I could almost describe this to someone. It's like watching Friday 13th, but you're outside looking through these different colored panes, and it's influencing everything you see in a kaleidoscopic, colorful, imaginative, in an interesting way, because it definitely has that feeling. And the way they achieve some of those things, if you delve into it a little bit after you watch the movie and kind of investigate, I've seen a lot of movies that will stick up a blue light to be night. You know, a lot of Hollywood films that haven't aged well, you'll watch their day for night shots and you're like, oh my God, like, did you just put a little piece of blue film over, you know, a light and think we could believe it's night? But Lucio Tivoli, the cinematographer, he did some really crazy stuff. I'm not a cinematography expert, but he one of the big ones he talks about is he would reflect light. He wouldn't cast any of the light directly onto the actors. He would get tons of mirrors, and they would reflect these really hot lights directly at the mirrors, which would then bounce these colors. So he was trying not to use gels and traditional filters. So he tried to not use any of the traditional tricks to light this film, and that to create a new effect that hadn't really been done. And that paired with the three strip Technicolor film stock, which is the last of its kind. So this is the last movie in the history of cinema that was filmed on this particular use of Technicolor, something called dye printing, when you're printing up something. I don't really understand the whole that dye transfer, but it created, you know, like Wizard of Oz and other movies, this very where the colors are all treated independently, so they all pop individually. There's nothing being muted because they're not all being worked on at once. And, you know, so there's all this stuff happening. And from what I read, he didn't really feel that confident. His background was realism, and he had only made realistic looking pictures. And Argento kind of said to him, well, you know, I want to do all this stuff. And he was like, oh God, I don't know about that. And he said, let me do a test. Don't hire me. Just let me do a test. And the story, which is a very sweet story that I just read about in a book, it was that Argento was so moved, he stood up, walked over the screen, and just kind of touched the screen and said, this is beautiful, you know. And it was that idea that it almost seems like what the movie's trying to do is like make you touch the movie, like it's different aesthetically, you know. And it's, there aren't many films like this, so.
No, agreed entirely. Yeah. And it is constantly stunning, you know, even with that opening sequence. You're right. I mean, the panes of glass as they're shattered and falling down, you know, even as she's being hung. I mean, it's, you're sort of stunned at the brutality and the gore, but at the same time, it's just, you're sort of transfixed by how beautiful and, you know, strange it all is. And, you know, ultimately how utterly lethal it is too, because her poor friend is skewered by the broken glass as well. I mean, it's sort of two deaths for the price of one so far as the killer goes. But I mean, it's just such an amazing way to open that film, I think. And, you know, you did mention Hitchcock a moment ago, and, you know, it reminded me, I've seen this from time to time, Argento being referred to as the Italian Hitchcock, and I'm wondering if you think that description is fully accurate. You know, I mean, they're both sort of masters at crafting suspense, I think, but, you know, Hitchcock seemed happy, I think, to sort of make the violence more suggestive, you know, not counting some of the work in his later years, whereas, you know, Argento's violence is much more explicit and very sort of in-your-face, plus, you know, I don't know. Do Argento's concerns, do you think, appear to mirror Hitchcock's in any way? And for that matter, like, what are Argento's concerns, do you think? You know, does he have any, or is his work more, and I'm not knocking him for this, but do you think his work is more style over substance more often than not?
Well, I'll keep, if this was a debate, I'd keep going back to his style is substance in these movies. But I do think, no, I think there's a lot of similarities. I think the thing you said Hitchcock was content with, I think Hitchcock is a product of the time he was making his films, and Argento is a product of when he was making his. So the cinema had already had all of Hitchcock's work, except for maybe his last couple of movies, by the time we're seeing Dario's film. So I think, especially in a horror film, and Psycho is the one that changes it. So, and Psycho did up the violence, and is still suggestive, but, you know, that shower scene's far from suggestive. It's, I think the shower scene and the way music is used in that, and the way all the cuts are used, is about as close to the use of this opening murder scene in Suspiria of Goblin playing, you know, at 100 decibels blasting away while you're watching this ferocious thing unfold in front of you, and it's beautiful and confusing all at the same time. I think they both, obviously, as well as De Palma, you know, all three of them have stylized murder, woman largely as the victims, movies by men about woman in peril. So you question, oh, what's that about? Why are women almost always the, you know, central figure of these films to the most part? I don't know if Dario has anything particularly deep that he's trying to express. I don't think Hitchcock did either. I think each project was something, you know, he was going to attack. I think themes popped through because he would let them sift into his work, you know, Vertigo being, you know, the most personal, but letting his own sexual and psychological ideas about women, about men and women, obsession, love, those things come through clearer in Hitchcock's films than Argento's, I think. But Argento's always playing with gender He's always, I mean, if you go to Tenebrae, which I think is his, next to Suspiria, I think it's his best made movie. I think it's the one movie that most people could get into. If they were like, Suspiria's the fairy tale, I think Tenebrae is like a nearly perfect thriller, and it's just got all the great set pieces, and it's definitely his most Hitchcockian. It's the one where you could just clearly go Hitchcock. I would be shocked if Hitchcock didn't enjoy that film, because I think Hitchcock has a very perverse side to him. I don't think that I know that from all accounts, and I think if he had another 30 years left in him by the time, say, he was making Frenzy, which was a pretty dark film in its own right, I think he definitely would have gone a direction like this. He made it very clear one of the later films he really wanted to make was called Kaleidoscope. And there's still some images, some experimental images that he had done tests for, which was going to be his Brian De Palma film, basically, as funny as that sounds, given that De Palma is an acolyte of Hitchcock's. He was going to make something that was going to be all nudity, absolute violence of woman, push the envelope as far as it has ever been pushed, was his plan. And so you see all these test photos of like nudity and stuff, and it's like, oh god, it almost doesn't feel right, because I think what works with Hitchcock so well is the suggestive nature, and it makes you the buttoned up thing that makes you desire the thing even more, or wonder what the thing really is, versus seeing it all laid bare in front of you, which is where cinema went in the 70s. You know, there's no buttoned upness in most Italian giallo films. Most of it's, there's a lot more TNA, and just sexual politics had changed. So I think there's a lot of intersection between them. And I think a lot of it's just, he just really loved the way that Hitchcock's films are really made by a filmmaker. This is not something that happens accidentally or a series of compromises by a director that ends up on a screen. This is a person had a clear vision, and he got that vision onto the screen, however he had to do that. And I think that's probably how Dario is approaching, especially from this movie onwards, where from all accounts of working with him, you know, there was only one way he wanted it, which is the way he had in his head. And even the DP says, it's not me, this is all Dario. I mean, I'm solving his problems of how to do it, but he is suggesting that he wants green light here and pink light here and red light here and, you know, blue drowning out this entire scene. So I think that's a big part of it. Two craftsmen who want to be in charge of what they're putting up there.
Absolutely. And it is worth saying, I think, that Argento, you know, I think when you say his name, I mean, at least for me anyway, as a fan of his work, I mean, when I hear his name, I think, you know, gorgeous visuals and, you know, really, really intensely violent scenes at times. But, you know, rewatching Suspiria again, it's worth noting that he really can sell emotion and intensity so well and so deftly. I'm thinking one of the moments here, like where Susie starts feeling ill and she begins stumbling down the hallway as Goblin's music starts to rise. And, you know, the camera work is sort of very measured and there aren't a lot of tricks on display, but, you know, just the way everything comes together, you immediately sort of, you know, feel her impending weakness, you know, which follows into the next scene. And, you know, a lot of the performances, when they're not sort of, and I know this is part of the charm for a lot of people, and admittedly for me too, but when the performances aren't marred by, you know, some dodgy dubbing, you know, I mean, he can get really great performances out of actors. And I think he was capable of so much more than what we immediately attribute to him when, you know, his name is called to mind.
Yeah, and that's always hard. It is hard to gauge because, you know, the Italian system, especially at Cinecittà Studios and stuff, I believe that's the studio where it was never built for sound, because it was right in the middle of a city, so it's just abysmal for sound recording. So literally any sound you record is not worth having. So everything's post ADR. And then the marketing idea for this period of Italian film was, all right, we'll dub everything. We'll dub it into multiple languages with English actors, German actors. I mean, these casts have, you know, a mixture of German speaking actors, Italian speaking actors, and English speaking actors. And almost all of his films in that period did have this weird mixture. So even I think some of the great performances are probably sometimes not much to do with Dario and as much to do with good actors, you know, like Jessica Harper just happens to be the perfect actor. I liken her a lot to, I know when remakes were rumored with this film, I always said the only person who can play that character is Jocelyn Donahue.
Oh, wow.
Because they have the exact same thing, which is they are not emitting much emotion, or not they don't have to try very hard. because what they are naturally doing on the surface is interesting, because it's almost like you can see them thinking. And if you can see someone's thinking and then kind of project onto them, man, I mean, they have to do that much less to work. It works because, you know, you shine these different lights on them and suddenly you're kind of reading into the emotion. And not everyone has that quality, that's for sure.
I mean, she carried an entire movie with that, you know, with House of the Devil. I'm trying to think of any other actress who could have carried the movie in the way that she did. I mean, you know what? 85% of the movie is entirely on her shoulders. And it's
the exact same thing. I feel like that and Suspiria have a lot in common in that sense. Yeah, no, it's just like the lighting. It's expressive quality. And innocence. I think they both have, they're not traditional final girls. They definitely aren't traditional in the idea of a haughty scream queen, half clad, you know, surviving through the bursting through the corpse of the monster at the end. And, you know, with a savage scream, that's not what these are about. And I think that might be a little throwback to this idea of it being more like a fairy tale, a little slightly more innocent, childlike quality. Maybe these are the transitions to adulthood. You know, maybe this whole journey of this movie is her, you know, having to get to that next stage of life, like something she has to go through, not something she's being traumatized by, like you would all the heroines at the end of, say, Friday Part 2 or 3. You know, those movies end, if they survive, they end screaming and, you know, they're going to a mental asylum or whatever it is. That's not the kind of movie this is, or not the kind of heroine we're watching either. But yeah, no, the actors are interesting. I know there's a couple Hitchcockian actors. I know Jerome Bennett was in one of the smaller Hitchcock films that I am less aware of, but definitely one of them, definitely a later Hitchcock. A couple of people have from the cast had been. So, you know, there's all sorts of nods there. But also, oh, sorry, and the one thing I did want to say, though, is, you know, how he cast Jessica Harper is also kind of related in this roundabout to Hitchcock, which is Brian De Palma. Phantom of Paradise, she plays Phoenix, and Argento had seen that. Oh, wow. And that was completely why he cast her. He saw the quality she had in that film and just wanted to cast her straight away. So, you know, there's a direct lineage there.
That's fantastic. And one wonders why she wasn't in, you know, more genre films than she was. I mean, one can imagine, I don't know if the term Scream Queen even existed then, but one can imagine an alternate universe where, you know, she headlined numerous movies based on the strength of, you know, Paradise and, you know, Suspiria alone.
Yeah, I suspect she's, I mean, I saw her also in another film I love a lot by Woody Allen, Stardust Memories, which she's really great. I suspect she was somebody who just only did, she apparently did Argento's Suspiria because she actually looked up his other work and thought it was extraordinary. Like, she's like, oh, this is really interesting. So it's not, I don't think she was like a horror fan. I get the feeling she was interested in working with people with bold visions. And I have never actually fully heard the story. She didn't really work much, you know, say in the 80s to 90s, as far as I know. Maybe she just, I know she ended up being a cook. She has a YouTube channel called The Krabby Cook, where she does recipes and stuff. And she still does that.
What?
Yeah, she's the Krabby Cook. I've met her once before at a convention. That's her thing. She has a cookbook and everything.
My mind is blown right now.
She doesn't even look much older, honestly. She kind of, to me, I mean, she's older. She's 40 years older, but she feels like the same person, you know, and the same kind of wide-eyed innocence. But and easy to also sometimes look at her and go, you look just like you're in Raiders of the Lost Ark. another feeling I get. But no, she, you know, it's an interesting, looking for the right, you know, performer at the time of making a movie is one thing, but that it would last 40 years and you'd still be looking at it. Like, she feels very modern to me. I feel like if this movie was made now and you put that same actress in, it would feel right. It would feel like, oh yeah, that's perfect. She's not dated by time, that particular performance, which I love that feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. And she is, I mean, it feels like she is the perfect person to sort of take you through that story. And you know, at times it feels like, you know, the film is purely Susie Banyan's story. You know, I mean, she's the first person we see and we really connect with, and, you know, we arrive at the school with her, we follow her, we see events through her eyes. Well, I mean, you know, not literally, but you know what I mean. But, you know, it could almost be read in a way as one person's nightmare almost, except, you know, the film does often cut away to others, you know, as they're sort of you know, brutally murdered. I mean, there's, you know, Pat in the opening, who was cut down and hanged. And, you know, there's, is it Daniel, the poor blind pianist, yeah, and whose throat is torn out by his, you know, service pet. I mean, which is just awful. And, you know, there's There's Sarah, you know, who dies horribly in the pile of razor wire, you know, and there's that huge long buildup leading up to that sequence. But I'm wondering.
And she's the only one we really care about of those.
True.
If you think about it, we never really get a time to care much about the victims in this. Sarah, because she's nice to Susie, you actually get, and she's a co-conspirator in a sense, you get to know her a little bit. So she's the only one who, when she dies, you kind of feel anything.
Yeah, and she is also the one who delivers the single most terrifying scare in the film. Honestly, that image of her revealed at the end, you know, when Susie finally happens across Helena Marcus and, you know, the poor Sarah's corpse is unveiled and, you know, her eyes and the wounds from the razor wire and that look on her face, you know, that almost rictus grin. Honestly, like, I even knew that moment was coming on this rewatch, and it still terrifies me, you know, that moment, you know. It just, I shudder every time I think of it.
That he gets away with, like, by not being constricted to narrative rules. Like, you know, if you're, especially from, say, from, you know, writing perspective, you're always trying to ground something. So you're sitting there and it could take you forever trying to write something because you're trying to make it, oh, how do I make this stupid vampire myth believable and real? How do I ground it? You know, and you think about what he's doing and he's like, okay, well, she's died in the next room. And what has this got to do with witches? Her as a reanimated corpse, you know, and they never show you the reanimation. She's just there with this wicked, horrific grin, twisted grin, and these little phantasm ball eyes and a knife. And it's just, and this is your friend. This is Susie's only friend in the school and only confidant. And it is just, like you say, it's one of the most nightmarish images, but especially for Susie, that's the most nightmarish image she could be hit with. And it's not restricted by any kind of logic of writing or conceptual thinking. It just is. And if you're sitting there going, I wonder how that happened, then the movie isn't working for you because he's banking on it not mattering. What matters is that in that moment, you are like, oh, shit. You know, he's thrusting you into it, I think, in that way. And I think that's a great lesson for creatives, because I think we all struggle with that when we're coming up with ideas. It takes forever to sometimes lock something in because you're so worried about jumping the shark, I guess.
Absolutely. If he'd even taken 20 seconds to explain why she's standing there, then it would have no power whatsoever, I don't think. And
it's a spell. His more than just a dance in movies, I think his films, this one especially, is a spell. It's a magical, I mean, the one book on him, one of the titles is Magic, you know, the man, the myth, the magic, or whatever. And I think magic plays a role in the way his films are cast, because if you break it for a second, there's a couple scenes that break it for me, but then I'm back in pretty quick. You know, I'm not wild about the bat scene. Whenever I see it, I always, in a theater, I really enjoyed it. I sort of, like, a couple months ago in a theater, and I've got to say, I was like, oh, that's right, the bat scene. I'd forgotten about the bat scene, and it somehow worked because it was almost like a little bit of a release for the audience to see something a bit more comical and bizarre. But I have to think, a lot of movies with real animals had been made. I have to think these are choices, like I've been talking about, like things that land. I get the feeling this is something he wanted, an artificial looking bat, like the old, you know, Dracula movies when they turn into the bat. And then she just stomps on and kills this very artificial looking thing. It feels like a purposeful choice. For me, that particular one didn't really land, never has really settled all that well. I'd also say Udo Kier's cameo. I actually had a fight about somebody at the screening about this. Not a fight. I actually think they kind of had a valid point. But I always said to people, you know, you could cut that whole sequence out of the movie, and I think it's a better movie. Because this is the one sequence where it's out of the academy. It's in normal daytime. And she's talking to Udo Kier first, like a psychiatrist or a doctor. I can't remember now. And then afterwards, it goes straight on to, oh, also talk to my expert friend. So it's like two back-to-back exposition scenes, you know. And
you get
and
like two Simon Oaklands for the price of one, you know. It's
yeah.
Just,
And it's realistic for the most part. And that's what that's how I always remembered it. And after making these bold claims, like often dumb braggarts like me make, I was watching it again on the screen going, oh, okay. For one, we do need some of this information. Like a lot of it is building the myth of Helena Marcos, the Black Queen, and you just needed it. You needed to really make this kind of a legendary kind of tale. It could have been elsewhere. Like girls could have been talking about it. That would have been fine too. But in this case, you couldn't just cut it out. But Udo Kier has the best line in the whole movie. You know, what is it? The
bad luck is not brought by broken mirrors, but by broken minds.
By broken minds, yep. Which became the title of the one of books on Argento. Perfect line. But then what it does, and I only noticed this on the last viewing, is it starts shooting the second person she meets, the older doctor. Starts shooting it in the reflection of the mirror of the building, and by doing that, it starts to reveal, I guess, a sense that they're being watched, that they're not in the that the real world is not going to be an escape from what's coming, and it starts bending the shape of things again. And I think that is just what makes it like a fascinating kind of sequence, because they're always thinking. So it goes from being, it's still not to me the strongest part of the movie by any means, but I've kind of been won over to it, not just being something I would chop. But you know, it's those are the kind of risks, you know, he's taking throughout. Also, Udo Kier, I think he's dubbed in this. Yeah, of course, he's dubbed into like perfect American English, at least in our version. Who knows in Latvia which version they got? They got pure uncut Udo, which is what we all need. The blood of these whores is killing me. another great Udo. And again, he was cast because of the Paul Marcy films. Like, you know, Dario Argento was a very film literate guy. He'd seen him in those movies and thought he could do this. You know, people forget about, you know, that Dario also wrote, you know, Once Upon a Time, no, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, was it, or is it Once Upon a Time in the West? It's skirting me now. I think with Bernard Bertolucci, I think it's Good, Bad, and Ugly, was a co-writer on that script. So what I noticed, I went to an Argento all-nighter a couple months ago, six weeks or something, and we saw, you know, we stayed up all night and we watched these films from in chronological order, not all of his films, but enough. And what I noticed is the writing of his first three films is so much stronger than the writing of his best period of films, Suspiria, Deep Red, you know, Inferno. And so I have to believe that this was a conscious choice on his part to change and go more towards, you know, pure cinema stylist version of a filmmaker, not a limitation on him as being a bad writer, which I think is one of the kind of sadder things that I think he gets hit with a lot. And he's made a lot of, you know, in my opinion, pretty bad films in the last 10 years, or just certainly not up to the same level that these were. But I viewed watching them in order, I was like, oh my God, the writing of Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Cat of Nine Tails, it's really sharp, funny, witty dialogue, clever characters, puns, like the stuff of a writer. And the visuals are good, and they kind of they reinforce the story you're watching, but they are not the story. That style hadn't become substance. And then once he gets to these other movies, it's almost like he realized, oh, I can't. You can't be both, which is interesting. Tenebrae is a little bit of both, but hasn't got the visual experimental quality at all of those films. You know, it's got beautiful long takes and, you know, elaborate camera moves, but it isn't doing anything particularly new with the color palette. It's a very realistic, you know, looking film on that level. So yeah, it's pretty interesting. I would say there's a filmmaker that is almost never mentioned, you know, in this conversation, even though I'm sure Dario's talked about him at length, but just weirdly enough, I've been watching all these Val Luden produced RKO horror films, and especially Jacques Tenier's horror films. And watching Suspiria, I'm just thinking, okay, the influence of cat people is all over this movie, even down to the scene where the two girls are in the pool swimming together, which has, you know, part of a major scene towards the end of Cat People, where the protagonist is trapped in a pool while the thing is stalking her. But the way it treats lighting and expressionism, I really, as well, the Seventh Victim is all kind of about the occult and a group of Satanists getting together, which feels very much like it could have had an influence story-wise on Suspiria. So I think Luden's work might be one of the great connectors to Argento, you know, if people really chased it. And I found a quote by him that I thought might be the greatest quote about making movies I've ever seen. And it was just Val Luden saying, filmmaking is like writing on water. And I still don't know exactly what he means, but it seems to apply to this movie. And I wonder if it kind of means it's not locked down and it's always shimmering and moving and it's not what you're writing down. So if you write on paper, that's what it is. But if you're riding on water with light, for potentially, it's always going to be ever moving and changing and shifting and becoming and something more unique. It could have been a much more literal version of that quote, but when I read it, I was like, that just feels to nail something about movies, and especially movies like this that are harder to pin down.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's something that he did so very well early on in his career, but you did mention that, you know, in the last 10 years, you know, I would almost say possibly his last 20 years, you know, his output, unfortunately, hasn't been as strong as, you know, his early years. I mean, I think his last truly great movie was the first one that I ever watched of his. And I will probably catch hell for admitting that I like this movie. I know the movie certainly has its detractors, but the first Argento I ever saw, it wasn't Suspiria, it wasn't Deep Red, it wasn't a Tenebrae or Phenomena or any of the more well-known movies. The first one I managed to catch was the Stendhal Syndrome.
Yeah, I think that's his last. I mean, well, I think that's his most underrated last movie.
It's so
I think
good.
Opera is his last masterpiece, like flat out almost in line with the other movies, like brilliant movie. And then I think Stendhal is like this one that is just misunderstood. Again, a similar problem Hitchcock, De Palma constantly is leveled with this, which is misogyny. And I think in cinema, that's a complex term because I think you're exploring a topic of misogyny a lot of the time in these movies and these characters. So to be labeled as being some domineering misogynist yourself is a little unfair because you're not able to respond. It's a movie, you know, you're creating a world with a character doing something. And I think that's that because of the rape and, you know, maybe by casting Asia as the lead in a film like that, maybe he got a lot of flack for that. But I think that I'm with you. I think of his latter period, that's a film that maybe if it gets a proper release, like if that was an Arrow film box set, everyone would suddenly get wet for, you know?
Absolutely.
I think that's a problem. I think that's one of the weird things about distribution now. They kind of are picking what people suddenly get excited and nostalgic for. It's not always the right movie.
Creepshow 2?
Yeah, you know. Hey, The Raft's great.
The Raft is great. I was stunned when they put that out. And, you know, I will admit, you know, when it comes to a lot of these labels, when they put, you know, a certain movie out, like, you know, an older title, there is sort of the knee-jerk reaction to immediately fall in love with it, even if you didn't really care for it to begin with. So, yeah, but with Creepshow 2, it sort of got me wondering whether or not, you know, if Arrow were to put out a lesser Argento, you know, would I then want to reappraise it, you know, just because a label is sort of, you know, validating its existence in a way. You know, I don't know if I would need to pick up an Arrow special edition of Do You Like Hitchcock?
Yeah, that one does fall. But I think if they did, an interesting way to do it would be, say, the last five or so films to put in a, say, a box set and make it, you know, cheaper, but make them all beautiful. I'll tell you what, of the latter period, I still have never seen Dracula 3D. I've seen a sequence of it that was at a big screening that Argento was at with Suspiria, and then they played like it hadn't finished. And it, you know, didn't look like my bag, but I'll say of the later periods, The Card Player is shot so gorgeously. It's not a great movie by any means. It doesn't completely all come together, but it's the cinematographer that Gaspar Noé uses on every film, Benoit Deby. And so it just looks gangbusters. Sleepless might be the best last movie. It's, again, pretty flawed, but it's got some really kind of grisly stuff. Max von Sydow's the lead as a detective. I've only seen it once when it first came out, but it was one that I kind of, you know, kind of lingered a little. Hitchcock didn't work at all for me. You know, the third part of the Mother's trilogy has a great opening sequence, and then a lot of stuff that doesn't. The reason that one fails is less because it's not decent for later Hitchcock, it's that it's not up to the level of Inferno and Suspiria that we're trying to hold it to. It's not even close to that bar. And it's not even really trying on a style level. It's not shot in the same way that those two films are, which seems like a strange choice. It's okay as just a fun, you know, kind of end to that story, and it's got some kind of neat sequences in it. But yeah, so I think that would be interesting. But I'm with you. I do think Stendhal's the one that is challenging, and he's pushing the limits, and he's looking into art itself. You know, I feel like maybe when you do that enough, when you put yourself out there and it's not, you know, isn't met with the audience and the reaction you want, maybe you I don't want to say you start phoning it in, because I'm sure he's not thinking like that, but maybe you take some less risks. And Giallo is another one that is an interesting, a friend of mine, you know, wrote that. It's an interesting premise, but a lot of things happened from script to screen with that, like including Adrian Brody playing two roles. And you're watching the movie going, well, he's the detective and he's dressed in all this makeup as a killer. You're like, what? And then you hear stories that Vincent Gallo was going to play the role, and you're like, oh yes, that's a movie I would have wanted to have seen.
Oh wow.
You know, so again, movies are a lot of things. And so maybe also the changing in Hitchcock's career is also reflective of the changing of the industry. If you notice, when Argento was at his high point, Italian horror was at a high point. And it was selling everywhere in the world and making money and was popular. Good luck finding an Italian horror film. I cannot tell you the last time I saw an Italian horror film from the modern world. I can't think of any at all. And we're talking about a period where they had, you know, him and Fulci and, you know, Lamberto Bava, Mario Bava, Ruggero Deodato, cannibal movies, you know, unbelievable that is not a thing in Italy now, when you think about that. So it's like Dario is the last, you know, kind of, he gets to probably make a movie because now he's still a legend. You know, some new movies get made, but it's a totally different industry there. I think it's a shame that a director like that wasn't invited to America to play with the big toys at some point. You know, he's made Trauma as an American film. Trauma's okay too. Try and watch Trauma again recently. It's bonkers. It's, you know, it ends in one of those ways where you're just, oh my God, this is the craziest twist to a movie I almost think ever. I did say that on our show recently. I was like, I don't think you could find I'm not going to ruin it for you. This is one you have to experience. When you get to the end and it tells you why this person has been beheading people in this movie, you'll literally go, whoa, that is just one, the sickest thing I've ever seen, but also just who thought of this for a movie? But it's kind of fun. Like, it's got some kind of interesting stuff there. It's got a couple terrible things in it too. But that's shot in New Orleans partly. And I think Phenomena is really great. I mean, Creepers, Phenomena, I think it, the shorter cut is a really neat movie.
Really? Okay. That's the only one I've seen. I started with Stendhal, and Trauma was actually the second film of Argento's that I ever managed to catch. And, but weirdly enough, you know, I grew up in a small town in the mid-90s. You know, there were only sort of a handful of video stores around. And, you know, I thought it was a pretty knowledgeable fan for having seen, you know, every entry in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise and the Friday the 13th series, you know, and for having seen most Carpenter and Craven films. And it wasn't until I would sort of, you know, catch a stray mention of Lucio Fulci or Dario Argento in an issue of Fangoria that I would sort of realize that there was this, you know, larger world of horror films out there, you know. And there was this great site called Video Junkie at the time that would, they would sell VHS dubs of foreign films that weren't available here, pulled from like, you know, Japanese laser discs before, you know, DVDs really took off.
Oh, yeah.
And we started getting all of those films here in the States. But, you know, that site would have all these great synopses of various horror films. And the Italian films just sounded insane. The synopsis for Suspiria or Deep Red or The Beyond, you know, and, you know, like I mentioned, you know, my first Argento actually wound up being a VHS copy of The Stendhal Syndrome from that site because it wasn't available at the time here in the States. And, you know, from there, I actually managed to find Trauma. And, you know, at that point, you know, like Anchor Bay started putting out Deep Red and Suspiria and Opera and, you know, the Bird with the Crystal Plumage. I don't think that was Anchor Bay, but, you know, and then Suspiria. But, you know, I got to admit, at around that time, I also caught, like, you know, his Phantom of the Opera and Sleepless and, you know, a couple of those movies. And I think as a result of, you know, seeing his newer output alongside some of his older movies and the sort of difficulty there for a while for finding some of his titles on DVD at that point, I never really bothered to seek out some of his other better known, you know, works. Like, you know, I just caught Tenebrae because of that great Synapse Blu-ray, which and I adored it. I loved that movie. And I saw Phenomena for the first time as part of your October 31 Horror Films in 31 Days challenge. And,
oh, cool.
You know, I caught the cut version of that and still flipped for it. And I just recently bought the Blu-ray. I have not seen the extended version, but I was going to ask, which do you prefer? Do you prefer like the Creepers cut, or is the extended version better? Or
I always thought I would prefer the longer one, but I also just saw the Creepers cut at a all-nighter, and it was the last movie. So imagine you've been up 8 hours or 10, you know, 10 extra hours of your day. And I just assumed everyone would be dead on their feet by that. The place was rocking and rolling at like 8 a.m. because, I mean, when the final thing happens in that movie, which is one of the most, another one of the most bonkers endings involving a monkey.
I started punching the air when I saw that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how this entire room of people did. And I think a large part was because it was the shorter cut, because the longer cut, there is a few, I kind of wished it. Sometimes I, with these differences in cuts, I want to say, hey, can we split the difference? Because there's a couple extra moments of violence that I was missing from the opening murder, which is one that's always stayed with me, kind of like Suspiria, not nowhere near as orchestral, you know, orchestrated on an operatic level like Suspiria, but I felt it's grisly and ugly and intense, the opening murder of the girl and the Swiss thing and the guy on the, with the chains and getting free and stuff. In this version, it's a little bit neutered. But what they cut down a lot of is a lot of the stuff at the school, a lot of the drama, the back and forth, the I don't want to be murdered. You know, I mean, some of the dialogue's just terrible. And she's 14. You know, it's Jennifer Connelly at 14. I mean, she's still super cute. And, you know, you can tell that she's going to be a star. But, you know, cutting down some of that and going more to the cinematic flow, not the story flow, I think does help it. I think it's a better cut for sure. But I'm definitely missing just a couple beats of the violence. So I think it's cool that you'll have the option to have both. And I think, you know, his work's kind of like that. But yeah, I think if people have never seen Tenebrae or Opera, I think Opera is getting a major Blu-ray soon, I'm pretty sure. That film's a vision as well. I mean, it's an incredible, you know, level, an incredible bird, a shot falling, you know, I think it's a black raven through this opera, whatever, opera house, just kind of unbelievable, some of the stuff in there. But it's also tinged, so he does these beautiful set pieces and then tinged with the ugliest violence you can imagine, you know, like, you know, not razor blades, but pins, you know, holding your eyes open and little flecks of blood and this extreme close-ups on details on whether they be eyes or like you go to Deep Red and the first time you see the close-up of the killer's eyes with weird makeup and then the score kicks in. Again, we've got the Claudia Simonetti, you know, goblin music and it just pulsates. Those are the moments where he's at his absolute best. And, you know, and now it's a cheesy term because I've been using it for this other podcast, but that idea of pure cinema where these elements are nothing but what cinema can do. Those are the moments where his work is, you know, fairly unparalleled. I have one quote that I wrote down. I was looking through reviews before doing this of how the film was treated. And interestingly enough, this will blow people's minds. I tweeted because I was researching this for you today. But I, you know, it was it at one point was in the top five of the U.S. box office in 77 behind. I mean, just unbelievable. I wish I had a photo of it, but it was 1977, probably middle of the year. Star Wars was number one. Smokey and the Bandit, number two. Rabid by David Cronenberg, number three.
What?
The Spy Who Loved Me, number four. And Suspiria, number five at the U.S. box office.
No.
Can you imagine living in that world where those are your choices?
I want to live in that world.
It's unbelievable. So it actually did very well here comparatively because it was only on a very small amount of screens. So it made one screen in New York. It was like $380,000 in like the first week or something on one screen. And they were saying like, if you think about that, it's doing incredibly. So, but one of the people who was one of the earlier you know, because, you know, it was met with reviews all over the place, of course, like a movie. But Jay Hoberman, who wrote a great book on midnight movies that I've always been a big fan of, and he is the Village Voice main film critic. This is the best way to describe, I mean, save your time. You don't even have to listen to me ramble. Just this one line. It says, a movie that only makes sense to the eye. You know, and I was like, okay, I think you've kind of nailed, you know, the only way you can work this out. I would also say your ears, but because it has got a sonic, but it's, you know, it's playing to this one sense particularly. And I think that's a pretty cool way to put it. It's so awesome to think that was, you know, a movie people were seeing in theaters at the time of release. And then our generation, I think, missed it because I don't think it was maybe as available on VHS, maybe in the 80s when we were, it's probably not till Anchor Bay, you know, William Lustig came along and really started giving these films the treatment they deserved and, you know, making sure people saw the films. But
which bless him for the early aughts and all of the movies that he put out at that time. It was just incredible.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I want to mention like another part of this film, the last sequence. Also, you're talking about the poisoning scene. You know, we're talking about influences. You know, she gets kind of poisoned and gets bedridden. You know, Notorious is all over that scene by Hitchcock. Snow White, which is another influence. I know he's been very candid about the influence of Snow White and Seven Dwarves on him and his co-creator, which is Asia Argento's mom, Dario Nicolitti, who's the star of, you know, she co-wrote this film. She's the star of a number of his movies, especially Tenebrae. You know, she's great in Tenebrae as the main female protagonist. You know, it's definitely borrowing things like that. But the ending, again, just goes this absolute cinematic sequence of, you know, you only have a little bit of narrative information to go on for her to figure out which iris to turn and open the door. And then this ghost of Helena Marcus, and then she has to be clever about how to see this invisible ghost and how to kill her. And then suddenly the place is on fire. And if the thing that makes this whole movie work for me, as crazy as this might sound, is when she's walking away in slow motion at the end, she has the smile on her face. That is what separates this from all other horror movies, in my opinion, and which is what I was already kind of talking about with her as a very different survivor girl, which is that this almost a sense that this all had to happen for this character. Like, this is a fairy tale about one girl who had to go in and slay the dragon and do all this stuff so she could get to the next stage of her amazing life. And so this isn't about trauma. It's not about her getting all fucked up. It's about her surviving that, and she knows it. And she walks out of there. I did this. I defeated, you know, the evil thing. It's almost childlike in its simplicity, but that smile is so unusual to end a horror film, you know, with a character in slow motion, just feeling, it's almost like you could have cut that out into a bad 70s sex movie. And it's the scene right after a sex movie. And she's walking down the street with a big smile on her face. It almost has that kind of catharsis to it. It's something, you know, and that's the thing about watching a movie like this a lot. You will start to have more of those kind of ideas. The first times I watched it, wouldn't have thought any of these things, but every time I see it, I'm like, oh, something else about it surprises me and kind of gets me excited to think about.
I'm certain we could probably talk about this movie for hours and hours, but I honestly can't think of a better way to end, than on that note.
I've got one analogy for you that you might want to include. You want it?
Please, please, please.
this is from something I read today, which made me laugh like nothing else. So the actress who plays Helena Marcus, you only see her for like a flash. She's more of a body, you know. Her name was Layla Svesta, but she wasn't credited. So I read this quote today, which made me laugh. Jessica Harper said, "The witch was a 90-year-old hooker that Dario found on the streets of Rome." And that might be the best place to leave a show like that.
Fair enough. Yeah, was that her voice as well, or was she dubbed?
I doubt it. I'm sure she was dubbed by an actress. But the fact that that's how he physically found his actress is perfect. It's too good.
I want to believe that that was her voice too, because honestly, revisiting this movie, I when she's finally revealed, you know, or at least her voice is at first. I mean, she doesn't sound what we imagine a witch in this world might, or at least not for me. You know, there are no grand intonations or sort of measured speaking or trying to sound overly ominous. Like, she sounds positively giddy at having been found out by Susie, you know, and she's so oddly lively, which shouldn't make her more terrifying. But
yeah, their witches are treated differently. That's something I guess we didn't really touch on is this, you know, The Witch, the new movie, The Witch, I think is a great portrayal of, you know, witchcraft. And it's so interesting how it changes to what, you know, a much more terrifying vision. But in this film, they make it very clear that the mythology of the witches is about wealth and power. It's about I don't know what their grand plan is, but it seems to be very much about getting as rich as they possibly can and to have as much power as they possibly can have. It seems to be the sole purpose of this coven of witches, which I think's such an interesting, like, just on the nose kind of thing to be in it all for. There's no dark lord that they're trying to usher in a new world for. It's just as simple as we are going to amass as much wealth as we can and hide it all here. So yeah, it's a very different portrayal of that kind of evil, I guess.
You know, it's funny. I just found this quote that sort of dovetails with not only what you just mentioned, but also the, you know, the notion that the movie makes sense to the eye and only to the eye. But, you know, there's this site called Fandor where an interviewer mentioned to Argento in an interview. He said, you know, the three mothers spread around the globe, you know, deciding about the lives and deaths of everyone. You know, is this a metaphor for the occult economical powers influencing the world's life? And Argento said, absolutely not. You know, it's a world of dreams and nightmares, and it has nothing to do with reality. And all of my movies are like that. I don't tell real stories, the ones you could read on the newspapers or watch on, you know, the telly. I tell stories that come straight from deep inside me, from the dark side, the strange bastard and perverse side of my nature. Maybe this is the reason why my films are so popular around the world. They are not about the daily life, but the inner self.
Yeah, and they also tap into our childhood memories of stories, like when we heard them as kids, the things that scared us as kids, I think he's capitalizing. So, yeah, I think that makes sense. And yet, as critics and as viewers, we're still allowed. I could write an essay tomorrow about how it's about corporate greed, and it's not wrong. You know what I mean? It's valid to have that reading of the movie, but it's not why Dario's making it. Just like David Lynch, people read David Lynch movies, and he's always like, I've never thought about that in my life. You know, doesn't mean it's not there, because you're being influenced by everything around you. So that's, yeah, I think that shows that he is an artist and he's dealing with it as art and not thinking about the social context of what he's doing, even though it's there, it's present. So yeah, interesting quote.
So can I ask, before we wrap up here, do you have any final parting thoughts on Suspiria?
Good question. I mean, I'm trying to think other than, I mean, I think I would highly recommend somebody to watch it with Inferno. I think they are very different films, but Inferno feels like he looked at Suspiria and he goes, oh, I got all these things right. I'm going to push it even further in that direction. And I think he pushes maybe a touch far in terms of non-narrative, but it's also a beautiful and dreamy film. And I think watched seen together, they do start to weave a bigger story. I think it's a film that if you haven't seen for a while, revisit it and you'll see that it will keep changing with you. And for filmmakers listening, you know, I think it's a reminder to take bold risks that you don't know the possible outcome of. And, you know, it always reminds me that.
Where can folks find you at online, and what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Shockwaves is doing well. We're a four-person horror show. We do interviews and stuff. If you haven't heard it, it's Blumhouse, and now we are Blumhouse's official podcast in a sense, but we don't talk about Blumhouse movies per se. And that show's going well. That's just you can find that on iTunes. And I started the new show, as you mentioned up front, with Brian Sauer of the blog Rupert Pupkin Speaks. And we wanted to go beyond just horror films, but we also touch on a lot of horror. I would call it maybe more in the cult realm is our interests. Cult movies, the book by Danny Perry was a huge influence on both of us, kind of brought us together, that kind of movie, that kind of cinema. So we have a show where we, you know, kind of we liken it to like being like a video store for your ears, where we highlight a lot of movies and tell you a lot of stuff we think you might be interested in and just kind of geek out about movies. Both those shows are on Twitter at Pure Cinema, and Facebook and on iTunes as well. So I'm doing those things, and as well as schlepping, trying to get movies made in life and doing the dance.
All right. Well, thanks again. I had a blast chatting with you and I appreciate your time, sir.
I'll look forward to being on next week for Inferno.
Excellent.
Keep it going. Argento all month.
Absolutely. All right. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, leave a comment, rate us on iTunes, tell your friends about us, and check out our YouTube show. And until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend. So the way we typically open is by having a guest sort of, if it's okay, give a brief synopsis or an overall impression of the movie we're talking about as just sort of an opening teaser. And then, you know, I can do the intro and we can dive right into the conversation if that would be okay.
So, yeah, wait a minute. A plot synopsis of Suspiria? Holy shit.